Welcome to Hometown Alaska. I'm your host, Kathleen McCoy. Our topic today, Adverse Childhood Experiences, or ACEs, came as a request from listeners to Hometown Alaska. Because ACEs might sound like a bit of jargon, let's quickly provide a basic definition. Adverse childhood experiences are events before age 18 that can impose damaging levels of stress in a child's brain. Events can include neglect, abuse, witnessing domestic violence, living in a home with mental illness, or having an incarcerated family member. In children, high levels of stress can change their still developing brain structure and function, leading to the likelihood of poor social, emotional, and health outcomes long into adulthood. Those later in life outcomes can include alcoholism, drug abuse, depression, suicide, but also obesity, diabetes, cancer, heart, lung, or liver disease. On today's program, we'll look at four areas that deal with ACEs: the science in a child's brain, Alaska's historical trauma, ACEs' cost to society, and finally, and most importantly to me, the hopeful path forward. This is a heavy topic, but I think you'll see as the hour unfolds that there's reason, lots of reason for hope. With me to tackle this topic, we have three experts. I'd like to welcome Joshua Arvidsson, director of the Alaska Child Trauma Center. Welcome, Joshua.
Thank you.
And I'd also like to welcome Kyle Wark, who is an Indigenous Research and Policy Analyst with First Alaskans Institute. Welcome, Kyle.
Thanks for having us.
Yes. And later in the show, we are going to have a guest from Juneau, Pat Sidmore, who is a health planner with the State of Alaska's Health and Social Services Department. And he'll be addressing the cost, which is eye-opening and incentivizes us to find solutions. I'd also like to tell our listeners to say thank you to you for promoting this topic for us. It isn't one that KSK hasn't touched in the past. Line One, Your Health Connection, had two shows last year. I put links to those shows on Hometown Alaska at alaskapublic.org. And we recently, on Addressing Alaskans, also featured Dr. Chris Blodgett, who is a professor from Washington State University, who was in the state bringing some of the latest research, and he gave a talk at the Lusac Library, which KSK also recorded, and I have that link on our website. In addition, my guests have also provided me with a lot of opportunities for you to dig down and read more. So I hope today's topic whets your appetite, and all you have to remember is go to alaskapublic.org, Hometown Alaska, and we have a lot of links there that I think you might find useful. Okay, well, let's start. Now, I said we're trying to move through each 15-minute segment covering one aspect of this. I wanted to start with science, and Joshua, I'm looking at you, partly because we have recent knowledge of what goes on in the brain and relatively recent knowledge of what happens in a child's brain. So let's start with how ACEs and the development of a child's brain, why that connection is so important.
Absolutely. So it is an interesting time to be talking about adverse childhood experiences because there's been a flood of brain and clinical research that's occurred over the last 20 years. It's helped us better understand how it is that traumatic experiences lead to these long-term negative outcomes. And there are a lot of ways of understanding that, but starting at the brain is a good starting point. So what we know from at this point, well over 1,000 brain imaging studies that have been done on post-traumatic stress, is that when someone encounters a stressful event, there are fundamental changes that occur in the brain state during that exposure. And one of the things that's really important to understand, I think this is really important when we talk about recovery and hope, is that those changes that occur in the brain when you're in an acutely stressful situation are actually, they're not something that's wrong with you, there's something that's right with you. That the way your brain and your body reacts to a stressful situation is part of a survival mechanism and part of a mechanism that helps us navigate difficult experiences. One of the things that's problematic is that when we're exposed to overwhelming stress or repetitive stress, that those alarm systems in the brain and the body become sort of the main response. And so to unpack it a little bit, if you were it's January or February now, so let's go to summer. Let's go to summer. Pretend it's summertime. That'll take us to a good place. It's summertime, and you're fishing along your favorite stream here in Alaska, and a grizzly bear comes trotting out of the woods behind you. And, you know, maybe you're around grizzly bears a lot, and that's not too stressful. But let's say it starts running in your direction, okay? So that's stressful for all of us, right? So what happens in your brain and your body when that grizzly bear starts running towards you? Well, you know, your muscles tense, your heart rate goes up, your rate of respiration goes up, you may breathe more rapidly. Those are changes that are happening in your body that you can feel. There's also changes happening in your brain as that grizzly bear is running towards you. What's happening in your brain is this system that we call the alarm system, the brain that's housed in the limbic system in the midbrain is activated as that grizzly bear is charging towards you. Now, that part of the brain is also very active when we're having strong emotional responses, both positive and negative. It's also part of the brain that's very active in both the storage and recollection of memories. So we see this activation of the system we call the limbic system in the brain. It's your reaction, your fight, flight, freeze mode in the brain. It's where you have instinctive and strong responses to stimuli and
survival.
Absolutely.
Survival. Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. Then there's this part of your brain, your cortex and your prefrontal cortex, so the sort of thinking part of your brain. It's hard to do this on the radio, but if you touch your forehead, that's where your frontal cortex is. It's a part of the brain that in humans is really well developed because we have to be able to do very complex decision making and problem solving. Your dog doesn't have as big a frontal cortex. That's why he's never going to learn French or algebra. But this frontal cortex is where you make long-term planning decision making. We call those functions, when you add them all together, executive functions in the brain. Mm-hmm. That part of the brain, as the grizzly bear is charging towards you, that part of the brain, you actually see decreased metabolic activity there. And you can understand why that would be true.
It's more important to run away.
Yeah, your ability to speak French or do algebra, not as important as the grizzly bear is charging you. So we see changes in the brain that are response to that stressful event. When you add all these we call it the physiological system, what's happening in your body and your brain, you can't really separate them when you talk about trauma. When you add these together, we call it the alarm system. And you can, again, this is a little hard to do on the radio, but if you can picture, you know, those, they're in every school and public building, those little fire alarms that are on the wall, that's the red box with the white handle.
Mm-hmm.
The way we think about post-traumatic stress or overwhelming stress is that if you think about pulling that little white handle to turn the fire alarm on, what we think happens is when people are exposed to overwhelming stress, particularly children, but also adults, or repetitive stress, it's like that white handle has been pulled out from the fire alarm so hard or so many times that it's sort of hanging off the wall now at a 45-degree angle. It's not snapping back into place.
And the alarm is sort of going off.
Absolutely. Now you walk by or the door opens and there's a breeze and the alarm system can go off. And if that's what folks who experience post-traumatic stress describe their experience being.
Now, but let me do one thing. I forgot to throw out our phone numbers at the beginning. Let me just quickly do that. If you've got questions, we'd love to hear them. We've got great experts on the show today. 550-8433 in Anchorage, 1-888-353-5752 statewide. And we welcome your email at hometown@alaskapublic.org. Mm-hmm. Kyle, go ahead. I cut you off there, so jump in.
That's fine. I was just going to say that, you know, part of the reason that I got into working with trauma, adverse childhood experiences, all this type of stuff, is because I saw a lot of it growing up and I experienced a lot of it personally. And I just wanted to add to what Josh was saying, you know, like when I was in high school and college and things like that, if something startled me, I would say, ouch. If somebody reached out and touched me and I wasn't expecting it, I would say, ouch. That was my default reaction. That's a very mild way of describing the fire alarm scenario that he's talking about. But I was afraid. I was genuinely afraid whenever anybody touched me. And that's just one example of mm-hmm. how these hypersensitivities can manifest themselves.
I wanted to add something that I think Pat Sidmore said this to me when he was just generally explaining this to me. He said that early muscle, that fight, flight, freeze muscle gets very developed.
Yeah.
And it becomes almost the default response to things happening, which is a little bit like what you're saying, Kyle. You go out even though nobody's hurting you.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas these cognitive or prefrontal or the executive functions, that muscle is so developed, the flight, fright, and freeze muscle is so well developed that overrides. And so let's take it to the child who's 3 or under 1, because I saw some interesting statistics. Alaska studies show that for Alaskans experiencing 4 or more, recent study, that at age 3 they had many of these. So why is it so important that this developing brain is being bathed in in chemicals?
Well, the most recent research in understanding the brain's response to stress kind of goes exactly where you're going. So if you think about this alarm system, you know, I talked about it as a state, when the grizzly bear is charging out of the bushes, right? But what happens over time is that with re-exposure or overwhelming exposure, the brain starts to take on trauma trait characteristics, which means that exactly what you're saying, that those stress pathways and those fight, flight, freeze response pathways start to become prioritized. And that's not just an abstract idea. You can actually see that in brain imaging studies. You see activation and strengthening of these alarm pathways in the brain. And if you think about a child, you know, the fundamental problem of exposure to trauma in childhood is that that brain is developing. Mm-hmm. So you're not talking about prioritizing a stress pathway in an already fully developed system.
Not the bear at the side of the river.
If you think about it this way, like if I were to be immersed in a French language class, and a 3-year-old were to be immersed in a French language class, who would be speaking better French in 3 years, right? The 3-year-old, because their brain is flexible and their brain is actually more able to shape to the environment. And that's the problem of traumatic stress mm-hmm. with young kids, is that it fundamentally shapes their brain to operate. You know, this is quoting a couple of brain researchers in the field have said the problem of traumatic stress is it turns a learning brain into a surviving brain. And that is not mm-hmm. what we want to see in the brain of a 3 or 4 year old.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it normalizes a lot of these reactions, a lot of these stress reactions. Like I was depressed and anxious in kindergarten, and I had no language for it. I had no awareness that this was abnormal, that this was not how it should have been. This was just completely invisible to me. It was unobvious that this was not the way that it should have been. You mm-hmm. know, that was default. Well, French was the only thing that I knew. Yeah.
Now, I imagine that the brain of a 3-year-old is much more elastic than the brain of a 53-year-old. But there's still, yeah. and we'll get into that, right? Mm-hmm. So the idea that a course is set at this young and vulnerable age, I think some of what this research is explaining to us is why we're having difficulties in schools, why we're having yeah. difficulties with people holding jobs or, you know, living the life that they might want to live. They're struggling with, but people might assume that's a choice they're making, right? That they're not understanding that they're dealing with the impact of something that happened to them when they were really young.
Yeah, they're kind of autonomic reactions. It's just mm-hmm. as soon as you touch a fire, your hand jerks away. You don't think about it. It's an automatic reaction. It's autonomic. Mm-hmm. It happens without your conscious intervention. And getting anxious and getting triggered and getting depressed and stressed, all of these things become automatic, autonomic responses for young children who then get normalized to that response.
Mm-hmm. Now, we're running up against the end of our first 15 minutes. Is there more science you want to leave our audience with? I mean, we gave them the basic understanding of why a child's brain, why this is so important in a child.
I think the last piece that I would add would be that the brain and the physiological response is just the foundation of understanding how trauma impacts children. Because if you think about children experiencing adverse experiences, it has a developmental consequence. And this is more about what trauma prevents from happening than what trauma causes. Mm-hmm. And so in context, when kids are in context where they're exposed to repeated violence or other forms of trauma, it's as much about the direct effect of the trauma, and it's also about what trauma prevents from happening. So that idea that trauma turns a learning brain into a surviving brain means that there's a loss of developmental potential.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Which means maybe the ability to learn in school.
Well, or be intimate and relate to other people and empathize.
Relationships.
Because, all of those things are scary and dangerous and difficult if you grew up in traumatic circumstances. Letting somebody in was a recipe for disaster when you were a child. And that's a lesson that you can learn really quickly and learn really well. And it can prevent you from having intimate relationships the rest of your life or impose difficulties.
Right.
It doesn't prevent it, and it doesn't guarantee that you will. But it does have an impact. It leaves a mark.
So we've got a caller, and I'd like to welcome them on to Hometown Alaska. Hi, Kevin. You're on Hometown Alaska, and what is your question?
Well, I was wondering if particularly traumatic childbirth, you know, one that goes on for a very long time, so very difficult on both the child and the mother, could contribute in such a way to cause these kinds of stress response reactions throughout life or through childhood.
What do we know?
That's a really good question. So we would expect that stressful events like that can have an impact on both the child and the parent. The question kind of leads into a whole series of questions about the spectrum of stressful events and traumatic events, and I would say that one of the things that's really challenging in clinical practice is that you and I can go through the same event and experience that event very differently. And for one of us, it might be a traumatic event, and for one of us, it might not. And so the question's a little bit difficult to answer because, you know, it's really grounded in the individual's experience. But I would definitely say that type of experience can be overwhelming for individuals and can be something that can be really challenging.
Yeah. There's also a lot of physiological supports that are in place because childbirth, you know, it's been happening for millions of years and it's, you know, not always difficult, but it's certainly, you know,
it's an event.
Yeah. Yeah. And so both the mother's body and the baby's body, I think, have built in mechanisms that are designed to kind of ease that transition out. And it certainly can be a trauma. It certainly could be an intense thing. And a lot of adverse childhood experiences can occur with no memories being formed. You don't remember being exposed to these things that happened when you were 1, 2, or 3, but they can still shape the rest of your life. So conceivably, you know, difficulties at childbirth or difficulties with attachment and things like that at child, you know, foster care and things like that.
Could have
those,
an impact.
Yeah, those can be forms of trauma that can impact the rest of your life.
You know, I did a little bit of reading, and it was on this issue of stress, and it was called the taxonomy of stress, and it talked about, you know, positive stress response, tolerable stress response, toxic stress response.
Yeah, actually, you had said, was there one last thing that we wanted to talk about in terms of the science? And I thought, as a good transition into the historic trauma piece, toxic stress was something that Josh and I were talking about before the show got running. It's great to have your body flooded with adadrenaline and cortisol when the bear is running at you. That was Josh's example earlier, because you need that. You need to be able to damp down
Get up
pain.
And go.
Yeah, you need to be able to oxygenate your muscles and all that stuff. And that's great for you for the 15 minutes, half an hour, whatever long, you know, however long it takes you to get out of that dangerous situation. The problem occurs when your body is being flooded with stress hormones like adrenaline and cortisol continuously, and it becomes chronic, so that it's not acute stress anymore. It's chronic stress.
Mm-hmm.
You can have a difficult week at work. You can have a difficult day at work. But when you've had difficult years at work, that chronic stress begins to degrade your body's performance.
Mm-hmm.
Adrenaline and cortisol are extremely difficult on metabolic functions, which is why you get obesity and diabetes and things like that coming out of chronic stress situations. It can damage DNA and lead to cancers, increased cancer risk factors.
Mm-hmm.
It can lead to substance abuse and mental health issues because it's changing the physiology of your brain to be flooded with these stress hormones all the time. And there are childhood trauma is one way of triggering these types of chronic stress disorders, but there are other forms of chronic stress too.
War, for example.
Yeah,
right, yeah.
Yeah.
The word is leaping to my head, epigenetics, which has something to do with not really changing, it doesn't change the underlying, I think I read nucleotides or something like that, and yet it can change the way your mind reacts to things, markers in the brain. Is there a little bit there that we could share with people?
Yeah, I was actually planning to speak to that anyway. So a gene codes for a protein. That's basically all it does, is it's a little pair of chemical molecules that tells your body how to produce a protein. And that could be a tooth, it could be a hair, it could be a kidney, it could be a cell. There's lots of different proteins. Your whole body is made up of proteins. And what epigenetics do is attach themselves. Epi is a Greek word that means like over, on top of. So these little molecules get written onto your DNA, and that tells your body, epigenetics tells your body which proteins to make. So they activate and deactivate genes. That's what epigenetics basically do.
And does that relate to why your fight response becomes a larger and your relationship building abilities don't develop?
It can, yeah. Uh-huh. There are studies with Holocaust survivors and children and grandchildren of Holocaust survivors, people who went through intense traumas in the concentration camps in Germany and under the Nazi regime. Those people had epigenetic markers that they could, you know, measure and test and discover in their children and grandchildren. So the Holocaust survivors' children and grandchildren carried these same epigenetic markers that their parents got or grandparents got from their experiences in the concentration camps. So their lived experience changed how their DNA expressed in their own life, and it also changed how the children and grandchildren's generation DNA expressed. And that included stress response. So there, it's not a simple thing like you've got a gene for blue eyes, you've got a gene for stress response. It's a very complicated thing, but there are genes that can influence how your body responds to stress, how much cortisone and adrenaline floods your system when you get, you know, how loose that alarm switch is, basically. Yeah.
Right, right.
And so children and grandchildren of Holocaust survivors have higher rates of substance abuse and depression and suicide or suicidality, all these different factors. And you can look at some of the epigenetic markers as keys to seeing how likely somebody is to develop stress-related disorders later on in their life.
So I just want to remind folks, if they've just joined us, that we're talking about adverse childhood events and incidents. And this was invited by our listeners, and we're very happy to deliver it. My guests today are Josh Arvidson from the Alaska Child Trauma Center, and Kyle Wark from First Alaskans Institute. And later in the program, we'll have Pat Sidmore from Juneau, a health planner with the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services, talking a little bit about the economic and social costs. But now, Kyle, I'd like to talk. We live in Alaska, a place that has had a long history of colonization and then an attempt to decolonize. And there's people have lived through this. And so I feel like, you know, that we have a special cultural need to talk about it in a larger context. And I'd like to invite you to lead us through some of that.
Yeah. So some of these things that we're talking about in terms of childhood traumas carry over into the concept of historic trauma. So this idea that traumatic events early on in a people's history, in a culture's history, can induce these kind of stress responses that change people's behavior. So it can make it more difficult for parents to attach to their children when those parents have gone through the Holocaust or gone through one of these plagues like measles, mumps, and rubella and things like that, plagues that wiped out 60 to 90% of Alaska Native peoples in the late 1800s and early 1900s, survivors' guilt and things like that. That makes it difficult for you to love your children because you can't be certain that they're going to stay around, that they're not going to catch a disease and die, and you'll be helpless and powerless to do anything about it.
It's too painful to even consider. So
Yeah. Or, you know, when you're sent away to a boarding school or something like that, and, you know, you're sent away at five, you don't speak any other language but your native language, but you're thrown into an English-only classroom where you're beaten if you speak your language, if you act out against rules that you don't understand and can't possibly understand, where you not only are being beaten but being forced to beat other children, where you're not only being sexually abused but that culture is being normalized to you so that you begin sexually abusing other children. This is something that I've heard from elders who've gone through the boarding school say that they witnessed. They would see these young kids getting flown in from the rural villages. They'd start getting abused by teachers, aides, janitors, older students, and as they got older, they began to perpetuate the same violence because it was normalized to them.
And it's intergenerational too, I guess.
Yeah.
It's just as we were talking about children of Holocaust survivors still having some of these markers,
right,
genetic markers. Is that the same here?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so I never went to a boarding school. My mom didn't go to a boarding school, but I don't speak Tlingit because my grandpa went to a boarding school and he was beaten. And he was beaten for speaking Tlingit. He was beaten for acting Tlingit or engaging in Tlingit activities. And when he came back home and became a parent, he made, like many people of that generation, he decided, I don't want my children to suffer like I did. I don't want them to learn Tlingit. I want them to speak English because I got beaten for speaking Tlingit. I don't want them to practice, and you know, this isn't exactly his scenario, but, you know, I don't want them to practice and learn Tlingit culture because they're going to get ridiculed and marginalized for that. And in some cases, it wasn't a conscious decision. In some cases, it was. I don't want my kids to suffer like I did. I want them to learn to speak English. I want them to learn to speak English without an accent because they're going to get discriminated against if they do, and they'll have no recourse. There was no legal recourse against that type of discrimination.
Is First Alaskans doing original research in this area? Or just using the research that's out there to see that filter and look at problems in the Alaska Native culture?
Yeah, certainly. So I'm the researcher at First Alaskan, so I've been heavily involved with original research into historic trauma and the effects on Alaska Natives and contemporary problems. So you can see it manifest in low economic outcomes and educational indicators in rural Alaska and Alaska Native peoples, mental health and substance health, substance abuse issues, all these types of things. We do a lot of work trying to draw the connection to show people how these contemporary problems have these historic roots in colonial traumas, and that in order to solve these problems of dropout rates and low graduation rates and substance abuse, what we really need to do is focus in on not the symptom, because those things really are just symptoms of trauma. What we need to do is resolve the underlying grief, this intergenerational grief and this intergenerational trauma. And if we could begin to heal our families and our spiritual systems and our connection to the land and all these things that were destabilized by colonial impacts, we can begin to build our people up and they will begin to heal themselves.
So it's kind of restoring something that wasn't allowed to take root early on,
I guess, in many ways. Well, something that was systematically dismembered, something that was systematically broken down. It was an explicit policy of the boarding schools to be assimilationist, to kill the Indian to save the man, and that type of thing.
I know we've had recent, for example, theater productions that have dealt with sexual abuse and struggles, and I guess I'm just thinking, what ways does First Alaskans use to sort of move us down the road here?
So a lot of what we do, you know, one of the plays I think you were probably thinking of was Our Voices Will Be Heard
by Vera Bedard,
who's like my cousin, I think. She's basically my cousin. Her grandma, in a clan way, is kind of my grandma's. Anyway, she wrote a play called Our Voices Will Be Heard, which is about Alaska Native experience, her experience, actually, her personal experience with sexual abuse, childhood sexual abuse, and how she was able to kind of heal from it, and some of the issues that came out in her family from that, family members defending the abuser and attacking the victim and that type of thing. So a couple of years back, I think it was 2-3 years ago at Elders and Youth, we invited Vera to bring up cast members to do a reading from her play to begin to get some of this story told. We had, I think, a special showing of the play after one of the nights at Elders and Youth that year as well. We've had community dialogues where we can talk people through historic trauma. We've done, what historic trauma means and what it can mean to them personally. We've shared historic trauma themes and ideas with the Alaska Association of School Boards annual meetings, that all the school boards across Alaska that participate in that organization heard about historic trauma, heard about boarding school, because it's an erased history. It's an invisible history.
Right.
It's something that people aren't taught about in the high school or elementary level, that usually don't even get taught about at the college level. I learned about a lot of these things with my grandpa and him telling me stories when I was 5 about his experience at the boarding school, but that was very rare. It's most common for Alaska Natives to first learn these things around their 20s and 30s in college. Most of the people that I work with didn't get exposed to these ideas until they were in their 20s and 30s in college or thereabouts through work. So we do a lot of essentially public advocacy, just trying to get this story told using our other organizations and venues. I think I wrote a story a while back for our First Alaskans magazine that was talking about impacts of colonialism through the lens of spirituality. So churches' impacts on Alaska Native spiritual systems and how they denigrated our spiritual traditions, said that we were devil worshipers and our masks were evil and bringing Satan into our communities and all these things that we were told that it's evil to dance.
Yeah.
That you shouldn't do Alaska Native dance because it's evil. That's really difficult to undo. That's a tremendous amount of internalized oppression is some of the terminology. So we talk about it. We give people language so that they can begin to understand and express and explore for themselves these feelings, so that they can understand how this stuff impacted their own life. We give presentations to our own internship. We have a cohort of interns, summer interns. They do a 10-week internship every year. And we talk to them about historic trauma and colonialism and decolonization and how it impacts your own life, and give them an opportunity to just spend some time reflecting on that in a safe space where they can share their stories if they're comfortable with other people, or just begin to acknowledge the pain. Mm-hmm. And that's the first step to healing is just acknowledging the pain. Like I said, you know, when I was a kid, depression and anxiety were normal. You know, running away from somebody because they were drunk and hiding in terror behind the couch, that was just normal. That was just, I didn't think twice about it.
Mm-hmm. It was actually a lifestyle.
Yeah.
You know, just to take a step back, one of the things that surprised me about the original ACEs study, it was, and I'm looking at Josh here just because, you know, it's easy to say, oh, that group has a problem. But what really struck me about this original study was it was 17,000 people in Kaiser Permanente. I think it was Kaiser Permanente and CDC. But the average age was 57. They were most college educations. They were working. They had health insurance. And yet the rates of them having early childhood experiences was very high. And that was kind of a window. So, yes, you have this historic and a group, for example, Holocaust survivors or Alaska Natives. But also in the broader population, it's bigger than we realized, right?
Yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, the average person has experienced 1.7 ACEs.
Wow.
Is what the original study pointed to. And we would guess that that rate is actually artificially low. And I know you're going to have Pat Sidmore on here later in the show, and he'll talk about, we actually know a lot about adverse childhood experience exposure in Alaska now.
Yeah.
Due to research that he and the CDC and others have been involved in. And I would just kind of building on what Kyle said about the cultural and historical trauma lens, I think you can think very broadly about fundamental developmental things that happen in human relationships and how adverse childhood trauma cuts across, adverse child experiences and trauma cut across those experiences. We have to think about trauma in this, as Kyle very articulately put, in a developmental context, and that happens both within groups of people, but also in the lives of individual people. So you can imagine like a child who's being exposed to domestic violence happening in the home, and let's imagine it's a 1-year-old child. That child is impacted not just by the exposure to that stress, and as Kyle said, they do experience that stress, whether they can tell you about it 5 years later or not. Even though they're pre-verbal, they may not be able to tell you about it or have the same kind of memory. We would have it impacts them. But what we also really get concerned about is what is not happening when that overwhelming stress is happening. And, you know, I talked about it at the physiological level, but we have to think about we have to go beyond the physiology of the individual person and think about the parent and the child together in that mm-hmm. circumstance. Mm-hmm. And what there's a lot of clinical research that shows that when there's violence in the home occurring in adverse experiences, it decreases the parent's capacity to attune to that child and respond to that child. Mm-hmm. It decreases the child's ability to elicit a response from the caregiver. And you start to see degradation of that fundamental attachment relationship between the child and the parent. And we think that explains as much of the impact of adverse childhood experiences as that alarm system and when the grizzly bear is charging out of the bushes that I told you about. Because as Kyle said, it's not just the initial response to trauma that is so problematic. It's the patterns that it creates in human relationships and experiences that then become very problematic over time.
Yeah.
All right.
It's that lack of trust and stuff too. Mm-hmm.
We need to take a little break. So if you've just joined us, this is Adverse Childhood Experiences that we're talking about. And I'll be back in just a moment. My guests are Joshua Arvidsson from the Alaska Child Trauma Center, Kyle Wark from First Alaskans Institute. And when we come back, we'll be listening to and talking with Pat Sidmore from the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services. This is Hometown Alaska, and I'm Kathleen McCoy.
You're listening to Hometown Alaska from Alaska Public Media. The program repeats tonight at 8 p.m. on KSKA Anchorage and will not be taking phone calls. You can find Hometown Alaska on iTunes or listen at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back to Hometown Alaska. I'm your host, Kathleen McCoy. And we are talking today about adverse childhood experiences. And we started the program talking about the science in the brain and also the impact on relationships that can't develop because of some of these experiences. We talked a little bit about the Alaska Native historical trauma that has been a part of our state's history. And going forward, we're tackling a lot in this program, and we're trying to talk a little bit about what's gone on in Alaska, what do our studies show, and what are some of the costs? Because I think the costs can be surprising to people. Problems that you see in society, you might have assumed had to do with bad behavior without understanding what might have precipitated those behaviors and what a difference it might make in a community if there was a an understanding of that. So I'd like to also welcome Pat Sidmore on. Hi, Pat.
Hello.
Thank you for joining us. We've been mentioning you all along, saying that you have a grip on the Alaska statistics, and I know that I invited you also to share with our listeners a little bit about the costs, because sometimes they can be quite surprising. In my introduction to the program, I talked about the cost, the percentage of people getting help through Medicaid, something like 40% have had experienced adverse childhood experiences. So there's a direct correlation between the money that we spend on things like education and social issues that might relate right back to this early childhood experience. So Pat, let's start with you, and why don't you lead us off? Would you like to talk a little bit about Alaska statistics, or just jump into the costs?
Sure. I mean, I'd be happy to talk about both. I think it's really important to know that, a number of us, including Kyle and Josh, have been focused on these issues, and the Alaska Mental Health Board and the Advisory Board on Alcoholism and Drug Abuse, the two boards for whom I work, we're very interested in this because it's such a big issue for people who experience mental illness often, and for people who experience substance abuse. Often people have a trauma history. And so we pursued with others to get Alaska-specific data, and it sounds like you've talked about it. I wasn't able to hear the whole first part of the show. But I wanted to jump into the cost a little bit, because I think that's really very important. Especially in the current setting that we have in Juneau here with the legislative session. So the boards, we decided to take a look at six different health issues related to cost, and one you mentioned, Kathleen, was Medicaid. And so what we did was we looked at these six items together. So we looked at Medicaid, current smoking, diabetes, binge drinking, arthritis, and obesity. And the reason we picked those is because we had statewide costs, annual costs, for those six categories of health. And so we went out and we used those studies, and we came up with an estimate that those six things, unduplicated costs, are about $2.1 billion annually in Alaska. Now, that's not just government costs, that's private sector costs, too, and includes missed opportunities, things like missed work and other not direct costs, but indirect costs. So those six items cost us about $2.1 billion. And when we unduplicated that and we looked at the link back to adverse childhood experiences, what we determined was that the cost, annual cost from those six things just related to childhood trauma, was over $500 million. So annually. So in other words, if we could have eliminated in our adult population all adverse childhood experiences for adult Medicaid, smoking, diabetes, binge drinking, arthritis, and obesity, we'd be saving $500 million a year.
Hmm. That's a big price
tag. That's a lot of money.
Yeah.
And eliminating all trauma is probably not really a realistic goal. But certainly reducing trauma is. And so we have a document on a website called Overcoming ACEs in Alaska. That's if you Google that, it will pop up. It will be the first one to pop up. And there's a document there that kind of lays this out. And what we did was we took our current rate of childhood trauma in adults with those six medical issues and costs and made a modest change in our ACE rates. So instead of being like Alaska with our current ACE rates, we looked like Arkansas, which is just a little better. And what we found was in those, just to change the ACE rates would save us about $90 million a year. $38 million in Medicaid. So that's direct government funds, both federal and state. So we're talking about real issues here and real money. I think another important thing, and you know, what I just talked about was in adults, that sort of savings. But I think another way to think about this is the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention came out with a report a few years ago that suggested that a child who is the first-time victim of child abuse and goes into the child protection system costs just under $50,000 a year just during their childhood as a result of going into that system. So we looked at it over about a four or five-year period, and I will say this was a 4 or 5-year period that had lower rates of kids going into that system than we currently have. We stopped in 2013 in our analysis. And what we take on each year, assuming that roughly $50,000, about $48,300, is we take on a debt of $82 million just during our children's childhood each year.
Wow.
For new first-time child abuse victims. So
the numbers are stunning.
Mm-hmm. they are.
Yeah. I wanted to let people know that the two agencies that you work for have put together these very succinct, they call them cards. They look like playing cards, but they have amazing facts on them. I use the one about Medicaid, but there are things like people being unable to hold a job or being unable to buy a house or the likelihood that they will need public services. It's a way of looking at the problems that we see around us and having a bit more understanding. Pat, I would like to welcome one of our callers on the air. So let's listen to Jim. Jim, welcome to Hometown Alaska.
Hello. I just wanted to point out from my life experience and my family that being in multiple foster homes from a very early childhood is really severely traumatizing, and you never get over the one foster home you're departing from before you're off to another one. That I was in 13, so I really think that it would be cost-effective from all of this discussion to have them go back to the orphanage system or some a group home system and quit putting kids in one foster home after the other. And I can understand why the native culture wants to stop that action and keep their kids in their culture. It is, you know, severely traumatizing when you don't know what's coming at you next. When you go to a new place, you might have 3 days of grace period before you break some rule. The next thing you know, you're somebody else's dog, and they're not going to be very accommodating to bad habits you bring with you. So with our society, events occurring in our society, with all of the immigrants coming into our society, it is not going to get any better. We need to stop thinking that foster care is going to create a beautiful home for this poor child. It's not. It's a false dream.
Thank you, Jim. I was actually thinking about the vast migrations across the globe of people, you know, leaving bad political situations, leaving environmental, you know, disasters. And I was thinking about the trauma that it's not going to go away anytime soon. And thank you so much for sharing that. And I'm sure that our guests here understand and can validate that.
Yeah, and I would what your experience brings up for me is this. This idea that we really have to understand traumatic experiences through the eyes of the individuals experiencing them, and when we think about traumatic experiences in childhood, I think we often we often miss the mark. When I do a lot of public speaking around trauma, I ask people what's a traumatic experience, and they'll say a war, a hurricane, an earthquake. Those are actually really rare. What your caller is speaking to is the experiences that are happening across our state every day, mm-hmm. That are having very fundamental, creating fundamental challenges for people, mm-hmm. and we miss mm-hmm. it. Mm-hmm. We miss it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's also worth pointing out that, you know, a lot of these difficulties, in particular, things like foster care, don't impact all populations equally. I think 45% of children in foster care in Alaska are Alaska Native or American Indian. And for, you know, he was talking about being thrown from home to home and these alien situations and things like that. And I think it was through the 1970s, American Indian and Alaska Native children were very disproportionately placed outside of their own cultural group. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't until the Indian Child Welfare Act was passed, I think in 72 or 74 or something like that, that the government as a whole began prioritizing keeping Indian kids in Indian families, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. which helped reduce some of that shock of, mm-hmm. you know, culture clash and culture shock and not knowing the norms and things like that. Yeah. So while these things are difficult for everybody, it's difficult for anybody to be in foster care. It's worth remembering that some populations are more heavily impacted by these things than others.
Right. I do want to welcome another caller. Well, first, let me just take a real quick No, I'll take the call first. I think I'm going to welcome Piper onto Hometown Alaska. Hi, Piper.
Hello. Great to join you.
And I want to also just mention a group that helped me get ready for this program. It was All Alaska Pediatric Partnership. And I learned from them that they had been going out and giving some public talks to Rotaries, business communities. And that's how I found Piper, because she had been in the audience. And I thought that hearing from you, Piper, was a way of other people in the audience kind of coming to grips with realizing the problem. So I just invite you to tell me, how did you learn about this problem and what do you think about it?
Well, thank you for the opportunity. Matthew Hirschfield, Dr. Hirschfield spoke and addressed the Anchorage Downtown Rotary, where I'm a member, about a month ago. He's with the All Alaska Pediatric Partnership and a colleague of Joshua's. And this was my first exposure to adverse childhood experiences and the scholarship and research around this. And it's a topic that fills anyone listening with much compassion. And so as a Rotarian and also in my role as deputy director at the Renewable Energy Alaska Project, I began connecting some dots in my head. You know, these are costs, this is an issue, this is a crisis that's affecting every segment of our society. And one small example of that would be Renewable Energy Alaska Project does work with remote microgrids in many of our remote communities. Mm-hmm. And an emerging question that's coming up for many of us in my sector is how we can better operate and maintain these mini electricity grids that rely on diesel and bits of renewable energy to provide electricity to the small community. If someone doesn't maintain their job, maintain their diesel generator, you can lose a $250,000 asset overnight, if not worse, leaving a community without power. So I began wondering, and I'm curious to learn more about how, this is far more than a question of someone not showing up to work, but is it rather not reflecting some of the statistics that are being revealed? If someone has four or more ACEs, they may simply be less able to work, less likely to hold down a job. And is that not what we're seeing in our remote communities?
And this is Pat. That's exactly what we see. One of the measures that we looked at with Alaskan adults was comparing their ACE score with whether or not they were able to work. And just like in so many other comparisons, the more ACEs someone had, the less likely they were to be able to work. Mm-hmm. So that is borne out very clearly in the Alaska data.
So, Piper, you can have experts who are steeped in the information, but this just came to you as a member of the public. And I wanted to say, I listened to Dr. Blodgett's talk, was podcast here on KSKA, and he talked about a business that dealt with an employee who was having trouble at work, lots of confrontations. And they had the filter of understanding his background, and And instead of firing him or disciplining him, they looked at his strengths. And one of the strengths he had was he was very good at classifying. He loved to classify things. And they worked it out so that his job became more of that. And so he was becoming more successful instead of just saying, you're just not doing the job, and we're it's something that you would bring into the workplace or into the school or even into incarceration probably. But anyway, Piper, thank you so much. Is there anything else that you want to add? I really appreciate you taking the time to call.
It's a pleasure to learn more about this and hear the expertise on the call. And that's just it. I think from a business perspective, the only thing that's exciting about having this discussion, and it's very exciting, is that there could be solutions. If we can take those best practices, then we might be able to turn things around.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Piper. And we did say to our audience that we wanted to get to the upbeat part of this show, which is our last segment. So we should go there. And I want to say, Pat, is there anything else you want to add before we sort of leap into where we can see the hope?
No, I think I'm good. I'll listen to what Josh and Kyle and others.
Well, it's daunting. It is daunting. But when I learned that people who understood their background could develop coping skills, I mean, that to me sounded fantastic, you know, or that a school might begin to see this not as a badly behaving student, but a student that's struggling because, you know, so let's talk a little bit about where the light comes.
Yeah. So if you go back to this, kind of takes us back to the brain and understanding how trauma affects us physiologically. We call it the trauma lens, this kind of understanding that trauma creates dysregulation and that has implications. And so we think about a couple core concepts in terms of building resiliency and supporting recovery. And one of those is this idea of regulation, which is that if trauma dysregulates you and it turns on your alarm system, then once you're in that state, it's really, like I said earlier, that your decision making and problem solving, your abilities to do those things is decreased. And so sometimes we miss the mark, you know, for example, in a classroom, when a child is dysregulated and their alarm system is triggered, if we give them 8 choices, you know, we're asking them to play chess while the fire alarm is going off. That's not going to work. We have to first attend to regulation, helping that child calm down, turn that alarm system off or turn it down, and then we can engage in the learning and decision-making and problem-solving. So this idea of regulation is really, really core. And Piper kind of hinted at it when she was talking, that this idea of helping someone achieve regulation, there's lots of different ways you can do that. And Kyle will probably talk about some very culturally appropriate and ways that have developed over thousands of years to do that. But this idea of regulation is really, really important. The second piece that is really important is attachment and relationships, because it's in relationships with other people that we're actually able to regulate ourselves and calm ourselves down. And that's the problem of trauma, is that it pulls people apart and it makes relationship really difficult. Mm-hmm. If you think about this in a development lens, right? A baby, if a baby is dysregulated and distressed, how do they achieve a regulated state? It's with the caregiver, right? An infant laying there on the floor by themselves can't really calm themselves down. They can go to sleep, they can disconnect, but to actually achieve a regulated state, it takes a relationship. And that's really true for us throughout our lives. So we think about this idea of regulation and relationship as kind of the two core starting points for helping people recover from and build resiliency in the face of trauma.
Yeah.
Kyle, well, and jump in.
You know, one thing that I wanted to make sure that we emphasized here is the counterpoint to, you know, trauma is resiliency. You know, Pat was talking about what would happen if we reduced all the ACEs in Alaska and how much money we would save, and then pointed out that, well, but as much as we would like to, we can't actually reduce trauma across the board. But what we can do is promote resiliency. You know, like a lot of studies have pointed to the effectiveness of having just one caring adult in a child's life and how much an impact that can have in mitigating a lot of these traumas. Just one person that they feel really cares about them and connects with them, and maybe they can talk to, or at least they can feel safe sitting beside.
It really could just be one person.
That's incredibly encouraging. You know, it doesn't have to be you know, a whole football team, you know, caring for that kid. It can just be a grandparent, an uncle, a teacher, a janitor. And if you've got multiple of those, that's just that much better, a safety net. Things like debriefing after a traumatic episode. So if a kid is in a car accident, don't just leave them be and take care of yourself. Like, talk them through it. Like, hey, that was really bad, but that's, you know, it's a rare thing and, you know, you shouldn't have to worry about it. You know, just being able to acknowledge and talk them through it calmly can help them learn to self-soothe and to soothe themselves after a traumatic event so they don't have that permanently switched on effect. And that's a really simplified example, but that's the idea, is being able to debrief with them after a traumatic event. Having a place that's a safe refuge, you know, a church or a club or a sports team or a dance group or something like that, those can be ways of learning safe spaces and building those trusting relationships. That's also another benefit of the a caring adult, is just that you can begin to build a relationship and believe that you can have a relationship with another human being, that you're not cut off. Spirituality and things like that too, not just, you know, a lot of people emphasize like going to church or these types of formal Western religious institutions, but for Alaska Natives, that could be going to a sweat maki fire bath. It could be in Southeast and the interior and in some parts of Western Alaska. They also do things like potlatching in mm-hmm. Southeast. We call that
ku'ir. I was thinking about food. All cultures gravitate around the table and share traditional recipes, whether they're from Ireland or Syria or wherever. Food has a powerful component there.
Yeah. Well, and things like maki, the fire bath and stuff like that, they're spiritually cleansing. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there are stories that I heard about really low PTSD rates amongst some groups of American Indians and Alaska Natives who went to the Vietnam War or some of the other wars, maybe it was Iraq, I can't remember. And when researchers looked into it, and am I conflating two different stories? I might be conflating different stories. But the point is, these people, these particular groups had preserved their tradition, their warrior traditions, where they would bless them and cleanse them before they went to the battlefield. And when they came back home, they blessed them and cleansed them and gave them a symbolic break with the battlefield. One of the problems with PTSD is that you bring the battlefield home with you and you're engaged in war in your living room eating dinner. Mm-hmm. And you don't have that clean break between the horror of war and the humaneness of home.
Mm-hmm.
And for these people, this ritual activity of cleansing themselves allowed them to come home in a spiritual sense, in an emotional sense, mm-hmm. in a sense of safety and refuge. So those types of activities can be resiliency promoting. And there's also a lot of stuff to be said around culturally based resiliency for minority kids, Alaska Natives, American Indians, African Americans, Latinos, having a sense of cultural identity, that it's okay to be who you are. That can be incredibly powerful. And that has had demonstrable, you know, there have been a lot of educational researchers who looked at that in terms of American Indians and Alaska Natives, because that's my focus. That's what I've researched mostly. Kids who have a strong sense of their own identity as American Indian or Alaska Native have higher graduation rates, have higher grades, you know, more income later in life and things
capacity,
like that.
Capacity. Yeah. Just capacity.
Whereas kids who are marginalized and don't connect with either set of identities, mainstream Western or Indigenous, they struggle.
Wow.
But just in general, my last takeaway is that trauma is not a diagnosis. Trauma is a destiny. It doesn't mean that you're going to have, you know, if you've got a traumatic past, you can get over it. You can heal.
That was that hope that I was going for, because I do think that we need that when we tackle some of these problems. And we obviously are out of time. I want to thank my guests, Joshua Arvidsson, Pat Sidmore, and Kyle Wark. And next week, Charles Wolforth will be back as your host. Please find us on the web at alaskapublic.org. Eric Bork is our audio engineer. Thanks so much for joining us today on Hometown Alaska. I'm Kathleen McCoy.
Hometown Alaska is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Hometown Alaska's theme song, Lead Dog, is by Kevin Barnett from Eagle River. Learn more about Hometown Alaska and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.